Central America, and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Julie Asuka. Julie Asuka is the author of three outstanding novels: When the Emperor Was Divine, 2002, The Buddha in the Attic, 2011, and The Swimmers, 2022. How are you doing today, Julie?
I'm good. How are you, Ethelbert?
Well, great to talk to you. You know, I want to talk first about not your novels, which I really enjoy, but about your, I guess, your first love, which was actually painting. So talk about painting and also especially the work of Joan Mitchell.
Yeah, I started out as a sculptor first in college. I was studying studio art. And then I took a painting class and I really just fell in love with the medium of paint. And I love color. I love the material of oil paint. I just think it's the most gorgeous stuff. I tried very, very hard all throughout my 20s to paint. But ultimately, I think there was a big gap between the painter I wanted to be and the painter I actually was technically capable of being at that time. So I didn't start to write until I was 30 after having really failed at painting. But Joan Mitchell, she's always been one of my really very, very favorite painters. And I was fortunate enough to see a show. There was a show of her late work, which I especially love, from 1979 to 85, I think it was, recently, a couple years ago here in New York. And so I was commissioned by the David Zwirner Gallery to write a piece about her. And it was the first time I'd ever written about anything that just had nothing at all to do with me and my own personal history. And I was so happy for a few months. I just was looking at her work very intently. I was just thinking about color. It was a really radical shift for my brain, I think. And I feel like I could just, you know, look at color for the rest of my life and be very, very content.
Well, I want to make this connection between painting and writing. One of the last writers I interviewed was Percival Everett. Mm-hmm. And Percival was talking about the fact that, like, he's a painter. You know, in fact, mm-hmm. when I did the interview, he had just had a show that opened up in California. And one of the things that he was talking about was trying to write the abstract novel. Okay. And so when I look at Joan Mitchell, her work is abstract. I look at Percival Everett's work, which is abstract. So I'm wondering for you, Julie Asuka, do you, as you look at your writing, going from painting to writing, is there something abstract about how you approach fiction?
I think what's abstract is my attention just to sound and to rhythm, and just literally where the accents fall. So I feel like there's just, whenever I'm writing this sort of underground abstract sound grid that is beneath the words, beneath the narrative, beneath the story, so I guess it's more like music. And I feel like the way I'm working now, it's not really linear for the first time. So I have all these sort of disparate pieces and I have to figure out how they best go together. And it's so that feels like a more abstract way of working. But I think sound is probably the most abstract element for me when I'm writing.
Right. Well, talking about your writing, I was reading The Emperor Was Divine. And when I'm reading this book, especially, you know, the last few weeks, I'm thinking about much of the political discussion about deporting people, you know.
About the what?
The deporting people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I felt that this is something where we look at the story that you're writing about, When the Emperor Was Divine, dealing with the Japanese incarceration, internment. And I was wondering about, what can we learn from the internment of Japanese citizens and how should we teach that history?
It happens so easily. I think that's one important thing to learn. I you can think that you're, an American, you're born in this country, that you're very, very safe. But things can really just turn on a dime. I think that's one thing that I learned from my research and just from being the daughter of a woman who was incarcerated. And I mean, what can we learn? I think it's important that this story be taught in the first place because it often isn't. I mean, I've traveled all across the country speaking about this book for 20 years, and still so many young kids just don't know anything about it. And the book has been banned. And I think there is a real desire to suppress these uglier aspects of our history. So just even looking at it, I think just
When you
look
talk about that ban, was that any books? Was it banned in California?
It was banned in Muskego, Wisconsin by a local school board. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, let's have a you read it. The actually how when the emperor was defined, how it begins.
Okay, so I'm going to read the very first paragraph of the novel, and the first chapter is called Evacuation Order Number 19. The sign had appeared overnight on billboards and trees and the backs of the bus stop benches. It hung in the window of Woolworth's. It hung by the entrance to the YMCA. It was stapled to the door of the municipal court and nailed at eye level to every telephone pole along University Avenue. The woman was returning a book to the library when she saw the sign in a post office window. It was a sunny day in Berkeley in the spring of 1942, and she was wearing new glasses and could see everything clearly for the first time in weeks. She no longer had to squint, but she squinted out of habit anyway. She read the sign from top to bottom, and then, still squinting, she took out a pen and read the sign from top to bottom again. The print was small and dark. Some of it was tiny. She wrote down a few words on the back of a bank receipt, then turned around and went home and began to pack.
Listening to Julie Osooka reading When the Emperor Was Divine, her novel. I was looking at what listening to what you just read, and we have Pearl Harbor in 1941, and here your character is dealing with spring of 1942. What is happening between December and the 41 and the spring of 42?
Oh, so much. I mean, there were elections for one thing. It was a very popular stance to take if you were a politician to advocate for the removal of the Japanese living on the West Coast. And you had evacuation order number 19 refers to one of many, many evacuation orders that were posted. You had these signs going up and down the West Coast in town after town, instructing the Japanese Americans that they would have to leave on a certain date. And for the Japanese Americans, they had no idea where they would be going, and what their ultimate fate would be. You had neighbors who suddenly, became very, very suspicious of their Japanese neighbors or anybody who even looked vaguely Japanese. You had violent attacks against people, of Japanese or Asian looking descent. Things just very, very quickly, I think, for Japanese Americans, the world was really just turned upside down. Right after Pearl Harbor was bombed, Japanese Americans, just many families started just destroying all their Japanese stuff, burning things, burying things, throwing things away, just getting rid of anything that could be incriminating. And make you possibly look that you were an ally of the enemy, the Japanese.
What about that fear that after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese would attack California?
What about the
Well, that after Pearl Harbor, there was this fear that the Japanese would attack California.
Yeah, I mean there was just no proof that they actually, I mean I think the fear was that if they were to attack California, that the Japanese Americans living on the West Coast would rise up in support of the invaders. So, I mean, it was actually a fear, and the Japanese submarine did it wrote a submarine emerged off the coast of Santa Barbara and shelled, just shot a few shells at the coast. I remember actually as a child growing up in Southern California, just taking hikes and just there were the cliffs near the water where I lived, and you could see these bunkers left over from World War II. And they were these concrete bunkers, and you could go down inside of them. And there you could see the machine gun emplacement. So there was actually a real fear that the Japanese were going to attack. But there was no evidence at all that the Japanese Americans living in this country were in the least bit disloyal.
In your novel, you write about the family, with your characters, the mother and the two children, going to this civil control station, which is in the, like, I think you have it at the First Congregational Church. What happened at these control stations?
Well, there were buses that would pull up, often yellow school buses, and Japanese Americans would arrive with, they were allowed just to bring only what, only what they could carry, so often just two suitcases each. And they would get onto the buses, and then they would be driven, often a short distance to a local, what was called an assembly center. So for the Japanese living in the Bay Area in Berkeley, the assembly center was a racetrack in San Fran, which is right in San Bruno, south of San Francisco. So it was just a meeting point. It was just a place where, and Japanese were very law-abiding, so they all reported as instructed to these, to the Congregational Church, and they did what they were told. They got on the buses, and they were driven away.
You see, I've been doing this close reading of your novel, Julie, and I said, "Oh, the church is, it's not a recreation center, but the church. I mean, they volunteer for this. Jesus is blessing us to
I don't
round up the
actually don't know how the
Japanese."
church. Yeah, no, it's a good. I don't know how these locations were chosen. I don't know if the church volunteered or if they were, instructed by the state. I don't really know. It's a good question.
I also thought about, in terms of, oral history project, of people who may have staffed these stations being interviewed. Like how you have people, like during election day, there's people who volunteer and they're counting the ballots and stuff like that. There must have been citizens who said, "Okay, I'm going to volunteer to give Japanese family their numbers." Or was that handled by the military or somebody?
They'd already been assigned their numbers earlier, before it, months before they arrived at these, at these centers. But I think there were volunteers actually handing out food. And that's a good question. Who would volunteer? I don't know, actually. I mean, some of them could have been neighbors that were actually concerned about their Japanese neighbors being sent away.
What, I was also wondering about where someone get a sense that the air is changing in California, and they're Japanese, and they said, "Okay, I'm going to try to make it to Chicago." So, was there any sort of movement of Japanese from California across to other parts of the United States that might have been more welcoming?
Yeah, well, not that it was more welcoming, but there was a short period of time during which Japanese Americans, if they had the means, could leave. So you often had caravans of cars that would just go, but they were not welcome in other states. They were often gas stations would not, refill their cars with gas. Sometimes governors of certain states threatened that any Japanese who came to their states would be hung. And they were not given shelter in motels. And so it was a very unwelcoming environment. But a few, I'm not sure the exact number, probably a few thousand were able to leave. But that voluntary evacuation period was very, very short. And then the window closed because it was very, very unpopular with the citizens of these more inland states to receive Japanese Americans. Nobody wanted them. If they were considered a danger in California, why wouldn't they be a danger in Wyoming?
Your book, When the Emperor Was Divine, has something that I was always curious about, and you write about it. And I was always curious about the relationship between the Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, in terms of, here the Japanese are being attacked. What was the relationship with the Chinese community?
Well, many Chinese wore buttons that said, "I am
The
Chinese."
Chinese, yeah.
Yeah. So that will tell you something. I don't think that the communities were particularly close. And I think the Chinese wanted to have as little to do with the Japanese at that point as possible.
Well, I want you to read another excerpt, because what we have happening in your novel are the characters in your book being removed from the Bay Area to Nevada, then on to Utah. So I wonder if you could read on, I think it's on page 28, I asked you.
Sure. So this chapter is told from the point of view. So there's a mother. Every character is unnamed. There's a mother and a father who's been
And talk
arrested.
about that, why you didn't name anyone. Is that a particular reason that they're
Yeah,
unnamed?
I mean, actually, I initially there was a name for the mother, and then as I continued to write about these characters, I noticed I just didn't want to give them names, and I think part of the reason was that I love the idea of, I don't know if you noticed, but in the first paragraph that I read earlier, you don't know the
Right.
race of the woman. And I love the idea. She's just any woman leaving her house to return a library book, and she encounters a sign. I mean, that's just a very sort of generic, abstract setup, not tinged by race in any way. And I felt like that's a way of just drawing any reader into the story. And some readers, it's a few pages before they realize that this
Right.
character is Japanese American, which I like.
And then, and that's when they decide the book should be banned.
They were Germans or Italian.
Right.
Not such a big deal. Let them stay. Don't round them up. So this chapter, so it's told from the point of view of the girl. So there's a girl and a boy also. So she's a young girl and she's about 11 and she's on the train going to this camp in Utah. When the soldier reached the end of the car, he touched the gun on his hip lightly with his right hand to make sure it was still there. And she thought of how he had touched her shoulder the same way, lately and with that same hand. And she hoped he would come back again. Then the last shade went down and the darkness was complete, and she could not see the soldier at all. Now she could not see anyone at all, and no one outside the train could see her. There were the people inside the train and the people outside the train, and in between them, there were the shades. A man walking alongside the tracks would just see a train with black windows passing by in the middle of the day. He would think, "There goes the train," and then he would not think about the train again. He would think about other things, what was for supper, maybe, or who was winning the war. She knew it was better this way. The last time they had passed through a city with the shades up, someone had thrown a rock through one of the windows.
Julia Silker reading from her novel When the Emperor Was Divine. There's two things. One, which we'll discuss in the second part of our show about your other novel, The Swimmers. But you do have this thing like this separation of people, people in the pool, people outside of the pool. You have that sort of separation. But I also was reading this and I was thinking about how, after a point, how we view in cities the homeless. We stop seeing them, when people become invisible. But then at the same time, when people are visible, we want to throw rocks at them or attack them. And so I just felt that your what you just read captures not just this period in our history, but also how we view ourselves as human beings and the other.
Right. I mean, I sound like, if you, if all of a sudden homeless people were rounded up and sent away to camps, like would people even notice? It's like some people didn't even notice that their Japanese neighbors were being rounded up and sent away. And some did, but who do we see as being, real and true and worthy of our gaze? And who do we just sort of just walk by and not even notice at all?
And we just have a recent Supreme Court decision where all of a sudden now, especially in California, the encampments are just being removed. So, where are people
Right.
going to go?
Right. I mean, they have to go somewhere. They have to sleep. I mean,
But if we don't see them or it's not our problem, it becomes an issue. I want you to read the next excerpt, because what happens is that you have what you just read where the characters are on the train, but now they finally reach their destination.
Right. So they've just arrived, and they're nearing the camp, and there's a town nearby the camp, heavily Mormon in Utah called Delta. At Delta, armed soldiers with bayonets escorted them off the train, and the girl climbed down the metal stairs one by one with her suitcase and stepped out onto solid ground. The air was still and warm, and she could no longer hear the low moan of the engine or the clicking of the wheels against the iron rails. She covered her eyes with her hand and said, "It's too bright." "It is unbearably bright," said her mother. "Keep walking, please," said a soldier. The boy said he was too tired to walk. His mother put down her bag and reached into her purse and gave him a piece of Chiclets gum she had been saving for weeks. He popped it into his mouth, and then he followed his mother and sister between the double row of soldiers to the buses that had been waiting for them to arrive since before dawn. They climbed onto a bus, and the bus drove slowly down the shady streets of the town. They passed a courthouse and a hardware store and a diner full of hungry men eating breakfast before work. They ran through a yellow light and swerved to avoid hitting a stray dog. They passed block after block of white houses with wooden porches and neatly manicured lawns, and then they were at the edge of the town. For several miles, they drove past nothing but farms and alfalfa fields, and the scenery was very pleasant. Then the bus turned onto a newly tarred road and drove in a straight line past the occasional clumps of greasewood and sage until it arrived at Topaz. At Topaz, the bus stopped. The girl looked out the window and saw hundreds of tar paper barracks sitting beneath the hot sun. She saw telephone poles and barbed wire fences. She saw soldiers. And everything she saw through a cloud of fine white dust that had once been the bed of an ancient salt lake. The boy began to cough, and the girl untied her scarf and shoved it into his hand and told him to hold it over his nose and mouth. He pressed the scarf to his face and took the girl's hand, and together they stepped out of the bus and into the blinding white glare of the desert.
You're listening to Julie Asuka reading When the Emperor Was Divine. Julie, I was wondering, in terms of you writing historical fiction, I wonder, did you travel to Topaz? I think there's about 10 internment camps around the country. And I was just wondering, are there different? Is the one in Topaz different from, say, one that might be in Texas?
Yeah, the only one that I've ever actually laid eyes on is Topaz, but I did not visit it until after I'd finished writing the novel. While I was writing the book, I really wanted to create in my mind just this camp almost inch by inch. So I felt like in the research for that book, I knew about just every single aspect of camp life. The camps all look very, very similar with barracks, these black tar paper covered barracks. And they were often set really in the most desolate, uninhabitable places of the United States, places where nobody else would want to live, often in the desert. And so when I actually got there, I think it was the year after the book had come out, it was kind of an uncanny experience. It looked pretty much exactly like what I had imagined. It felt very familiar in a way. But you could really just feel that sense of just desolation and loneliness. It's just in the middle of, there's just nothing for miles all around.
You know, that we'd be curious about, you know, is, and we'll get back in terms of when people return back to their homes, health issues of, like, you know, it's like, were the people who were at these camps, did they 10, 30, 20 years later suffer from any illness, you know, like lung disease or something like that from the air that they were breathing?
You know, I think they had higher rates of heart disease, but I'm not positive. But I do think, I mean, you're inhaling, the air was just very, very, very dusty. And I've also heard that, you know, people who go through some sort of trauma, like incarceration, do have higher rates, perhaps some, like, mental illness years later that surface. But I don't know exactly about, in terms of lung disease, how they were affected. But right. And I can also say that the health care that they were offered while they were there was very, very poor.
Right. Well, you know, while you have this last excerpt I want you to read, has a lot to do with the rumors that begin to circulate, which I felt could be very frightening to people. Mm-hmm. First of all, you know, you're taken to some place that you didn't know where you were being taken to. Then all of a sudden now you're there and you're hearing all these rumors.
And you're so out of control. I mean, right. In a way, rumor is the only thing that you have. Right. Every week they heard new rumors. The men and women would be put into separate camps. They would be sterilized. They would be stripped of their citizenship. They would be taken out onto the high seas and then shot. They would be sent to a desert island and left there to die. They would all be deported to Japan. They would never be allowed to leave America. They would be held hostage until every last American POW got home safely. They would be turned over to the Chinese for safekeeping right after the war. You've been brought here for your own protection, they were told. It was all in the interest of national security. It was a matter of military necessity. It was an opportunity for them to prove their loyalty.
Okay, thank you, Julia Soka, for reading. You know, this book is so important. You know, I was just telling people, you know, after I read it, that, you know, this is a must read, because it is affects so many different things. And then I felt that this book also is key to the swimmers, okay? Because the same way you have the rumors here, there's rumors that occur around the pool and the crack in the pool, and there's a lot of rumors that are circulating. And then also you have a character, in fact, the woman who's in the when the emperor was divine, now she's suffering from dementia. And so as we have our break, just before we're going to get ready to go on our break, talk about the connection between these two books and also the book that's in the middle, like the little sandwich here, you know, the Buddha in the Attic. So talk about how, you know, you sort of, and then, you know, you're writing a book almost every 9 or 10 years, okay? So something's happening there where you say, okay, I'm going to have this character in the swimmers link back to my first book.
Yeah, well, The Buddha in the Attic is really a prequel to When the Emperor Was Divine. So it starts with a boatload of young picture brides coming to America in the early 1900s, young women. And then it ends with the outbreak of World War II, which is where Emperor starts. And The Swimmers has a character named Alice, who could be the girl in When the Emperor Was Divine. And she's at the very end of her life now. It's really set in contemporary times. And I was just wondering what would remain of her of that childhood experience. That's what I was exploring in The Swimmers.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a little break right now, and then we're going to come back and talk about The Swimmers. My guest this morning is Julia Soka. She is the author of three books, When the Emperor Was Divine, which we've been talking about this morning, also The Buddha in the Attic, and also The Swimmers. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show is On the Margin, and the station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
African Diaspora International Film Festival and Africa World Now Project hosts the 17th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C., August 2nd to the 4th at the George Washington University Student Center, featuring fiction and documentary films, receptions, and Q&As. ADIFF D.C. from August 2nd to the 4th at the George Washington University Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org. or 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my wonderful guest, Julia Soka. Julie, let's talk about The Swimmers. I read this book and I felt I was reading two books, okay? You know, so I'm reading about this pool, but then it really got, you know, I came very personal to me because, you know, once you have a relative or a loved one that you've had to be a caretaker of, and, you know, you're witness to somebody who's suffering from dementia, you really capture that. But let's begin with this book. And, you know, I'm a poet, and so I'm immediately looking at, okay, well, Julie's writing this novel. This pool, what is it a metaphor for?
I think it's really a stand-in for the world. I feel like I think after I finished writing The Swimmers, I think what I do in my books is I create these communities, and then at some point they're eventually just destroyed. I mean, it's the same story with Emperor, you know. So it's a place. It's a sanctuary of sorts, the pool. It's a place where these people from the neighborhood go to do the one thing that they love almost more than anything else, which is just to be in the water and to swim. It's a place of community. It's a place where people look after each other. So it's just sort of haven.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you a personal question, because I feel this is the best way in terms of understanding your novel. Someone would read this book and say, this is a mother-daughter book. And so I was wondering, talk about your mother, and because you took care of your mother, because it seems that she suffered from dementia later on in life. And I think you mentioned, and she was about 10 years old when she was in one of the camps. So talk about your relationship with your mother, you know, in terms of the closeness. Was your mother interested in being a sculptor or painter?
No. And also I did not move home and take care of her. I just want to make that clear. I did not do that. I stayed in New York. But when I began to write Emperor, when I was finally, I think, ready to tell my mother's story, she was in the early stages of dementia. So it was a little bit too late to ask her all the questions that I needed to ask her. And I think there was always this feeling of grief when you realize that the person that you want in some ways to make amends with, who weren't particularly close, is leaving you, and you'll never get them back. And every day is going to bring them closer to the finish line. So there's that. So it's just a sense of grief at, you know, just missed opportunity. My mother, no, she was not a painter or a sculptor or even really a swimmer. I just feel like she went through a lot. And I feel like I'm still, even, you know, several years after she's died, I'm still just, I'll find things, letters to her. I don't know. She's just an endless source of, I think, grief and love and fascination. I feel like I wish I knew what I knew about her now, you know, 30 years ago.
Mm. Well, you do something in this book, The Swimmers, which I guess if I was teaching a class, especially a class on poetry, I would have them, you know, you read this, you know, section, which begins with the Latin. But, you know, what happens is that here you're dealing with dementia, and you repeat this line, she remembers, you know, you repeat this over and over in such a way that it's like trying to reclaim the memory, and then you're losing it. It's back. Read this excerpt, because when you mentioned earlier about the difference between your painting and then your writing, how you got into the sound, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to the sound of language, okay? I feel that what happens in the sound of language, what you do here is just you really place an emphasis on repetition. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and which becomes extremely musical.
Yeah, and it seemed like the perfect forum to try to retrieve memories, you know. So this chapter in The Swimmers is called Diem Perditi, which is Latin for I've lost the day. She remembers her name. She remembers the name of the president. She remembers the name of the president's dog. She remembers what town she lives in and on which street and in which house. The one with the big olive tree where the road takes a turn. She remembers what year it is. She remembers the season. She remembers the day on which you were born. She remembers the daughter who was born before you. She had your father's nose. That was the first thing I noticed about her. But she does not remember that daughter's name. She remembers the name of the man she did not marry, Frank, and she keeps his letters in a drawer by her bed. She remembers that you once had a husband, but she refuses to remember your ex-husband's name, that man, she calls him. She does not remember how she got the bruises on her arms or going for a walk with you earlier this morning. She does not remember bending over during that walk and plucking a flower from a neighbor's front yard and slipping it into her hair. Maybe your father will kiss me now. She does not remember what she ate for dinner last night or when she last took her medicine. She does not remember to drink enough water. She does not remember to comb her hair.
Julie Asuka reading from her novel, The Swimmers. Julie, I was wondering, this gets into process. Mm-hmm. I was wondering as you're writing this section that you just read, Are you reading that aloud?
Yes. I definitely was. I don't always do that. But when I was reading this, writing this particular chapter, I was. And I also remember being in a state of almost elation. I was just, I don't know, my brain was very, very happy. I just, I'm just moving around sentences and figuring out what would go together. And also just, it was a way of being very, just sort of being close to my mother again and sort of reclaiming her in some way.
I guess the thing I'm thinking of is gets into the thing of the writing as a physical process. I'm looking at how you were able to sustain this. Did you write this over a period of time, or was it like Jack Kerouac that you just sat down and just came all out at one time, and then you read a lot? Or was this a long period of time, considering what we were saying earlier about how long it takes you to write a novel?
Right. Well, this actually, that chapter came to me fairly quickly, which means it took several months. But I took off. I was working on the ending, I think the penultimate chapter of The Buddha in the Attic, and then Selected Shorts asked if I would write a piece for them, and I wanted to show them something new. So I did something which I never do, is I just took off time from the novel I was working on just to write a short story. This is really the only short story I've written. So I just had a few months. So I think, you know, normally I don't work under deadline, but deadlines can be good. So it really focused me. But the other chapters probably some could take a year or more to write. I mean, sometimes it's a question of finding the right voice, the right form, gathering enough material. And then I'm just a real perfectionist too. I just work sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, but everything has to be, you know, I have to nail it, you know, before I can move on.
Let's talk about you and your audience. And I should have asked you this when we were talking about, you know, your other novel, Whenever Was Divine. Your audience, I was wondering in terms of your reading around the country, does your book resonate with people who are, say, Asian descent? How much does somebody maybe who was a Holocaust survivor, you know, relates to you? In terms of the swimmer, have you been around people or organizations that deal with Alzheimer's and you know, and caretakers, as opposed to just a general audience?
Yeah, and it was really different. I mean, my audience, you know, for most of my writing career has been, if I'm on the West Coast, many Japanese Americans, and especially when the book 20 years ago, when Emperor came out, you know, I just remember being on book tour and meeting so many survivors of the camps, which was just, it was amazing, you know, and they would come up to me and they would start telling me their stories. Some of those stories worked their way into The Buddha in the Attic. And it was just really humbling to meet these people that I've been writing about and thinking about for years. But now, you know, most of them are gone 20 years later, which I don't think I realized at the time, 20 years ago. But of course, you know, but most of them are gone. So I was out in Seattle for Emperor, and it was the first time. So it was the first time that it was a new audience. I mean, mm-hmm. I had several events, and some of them were many Japanese Americans, because there are many Japanese Americans in Seattle, yeah. Right?
Elliott Bay Bookstore.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
I love Seattle. But then, you know, I had another audience that came for an event, and it was co-hosted by a neurologist, and it was fascinating. So the people who came to hear me read there were really people who were dealing with dementia, and so it was just a whole. Then I heard just many other stories that I, you know, that I hadn't really heard before, or that people had not shared with me before. So it was just, it just tapped into an entirely new audience, which was just very, very different for me.
Well, you know, I want to make a connection between you and going back to Joan Mitchell. You know, I was reading the Ninth Street Women, Mary Gabriel's book, you know, and it's not just Joan Mitchell, but other artists of especially the 1950s. Artists who were like in the shadows of their husbands or just didn't get the attention. And I was wondering, in terms of that sort of being marginalized, how do you see yourself as an Asian American writer in terms of the mainstream?
Oh, that's such a big question. I mean, I think of myself as just a writer, but I think I don't know, for marketing reasons, for syllabi reasons, that I'm often called, you know, a Japanese American writer. I just feel like I'm somebody who's telling stories. I work with language. I feel like a writer. And I, you know, I don't wake up every morning and go to my desk thinking, you know, I'm going to tell a Japanese American story. I'm just telling the stories that come to me.
You sound like Percival Everett and Erasure, American Fiction. Why are my books in this section?
You know? Somebody, a friend of mine, a roommate, said she went into a bookstore and she said she just saw a huge pile of my books like on a table, and then she realized it was, you know, Asian American Month, or, you know, it was the month during which we were celebrated. So that was why.
Well, you see how guilty I was. I was telling you, I had Buddha in the attic with all my Buddhist books.
It's with your dementia books for swimmers. You know, I don't really care. Right. I really don't care. It doesn't matter. Like, people can call me whatever they want. It's totally fine.
Well, no, you're going to get an endorsement from Katie Ledecky when she comes back from France. But, and I say that because what happens is that sometimes you look up, somebody's in the airport and they get this book because of the Olympics, you know, and all of a sudden you're reading it. But let's talk about something which is very, very important. I mean, just extremely important. Your chapter, Bella Vista, which is I'm looking about this in terms of the facilities that we place our loved ones in. And I think one of the things that we learned during the pandemic was that sometimes the condition of these places are not that good. I found there was places where what you write in this chapter is troubling, but there was also kind of funny too, you know, in terms of humor. But also talk about how you difficult was it to write, you know, this novel moving from like third person to second person.
It was not hard at all. I loved the voice of Bella Vista is told in the really the voice of the home, the slightly evil home. And it was the first time I'd written in a sort of a we voice, mm-hmm. that represented the voice of the oppressor as opposed to the oppressed. And I loved it. It was just, it was actually a very surprisingly easy voice to write in. I don't know if it brought out my inner sadist or what, but it was, it was a very funny voice also, but right. A dark voice. But for whatever reason, it came very naturally to me.
I felt that this was a place where you had to do some site visits. You know, you had to go to places and take some notes. Did you do that?
Well, I did visit my mother over many, many years, you know, when she was in various nursing homes.
Right. You know, and if you look at how we teach literature, what would be the age level for this book, you know, in terms of readership, you know, yeah. Is this a book that, for example, I'm 15 or 16, I should read? Is this a book that, you know, do I read it when I'm taking care of someone?
I think it's probably more appropriate for older folks. I mean, in a way, when you're young, you want to protect the young, you know, you don't want to let them know what's coming, you know, further on. I mean, why? I mean, life is hard enough anyway, but you know, in a way you want to spare them this, but I think, but you know, although many young people have grandparents and, right. and they see, you know, what it is that Alice is going through. But you know, it could be seen as sort of a downer. Although, you know, there's nothing inappropriate, I think, about any of the book, you know, that would be, you know, inappropriate for a 15 or 16 year old.
You know, when I look at all three of your books, Julia Suk, I wonder whether you've had any sort of people from, say, Hollywood or people making movies to want to turn some of your work, you know, put it on the screen.
No. I mean, who would want to look at a bunch of Japanese people like wasting away in the desert. It's just
we have movies on slavery all the time.
It's true. But for some reason, the Japanese Americans, it's just, I don't know.
Okay, let's begin with the soundtrack first, and then we'll work back to the casting. I tell you like that. Let's look at
not this. Not going to happen.
Let's look at this. Let's look at this. We know that in the last, say, 3 or 4 years, okay, the visibility of Asians on the screen, okay, Asian movies with even subtitles, okay, becoming extremely popular. It seems that also with more outlets with streaming, you know, Netflix, not just a movie theater, that somebody who, say, for example, is a descendant, you know, say, okay, I've always had this story. I want to tell this story. And all of a sudden it makes it to the screen. And then all of a sudden what happens now, I go back and pick up your book because what happens, I didn't know that. You know, it's just like, you know, after Malcolm X, after Spike Lee did Malcolm X movie, everybody went back and said, oh, it's Alex Haley. You know, and so I just say that in terms of, one, you're giving, you know, your work the opportunity to have a larger audience. The same way, for example, I'm wondering whether a book like The Swimmers could be something for the stage, a one-woman show, where you see that breakdown in terms of memory.
Yeah, I think there's been more interest in France in staging my work. I saw an amazing performance of The Buddha in the Attic.
Now you're confessing here on the air, aren't you?
But no interest in this country. And then somebody is right now in France also working on a stage adaptation of The Swimmers. But honestly, no interest here in the United States.
What about the translation of your book into Japanese?
Yeah, all three have been translated into Japanese.
Did you work with a translator?
No, because I don't speak Japanese.
I know, but still, you might, the translator might have contacted you about some specific things or something.
Right. No, actually, I mean, I worked most closely with like my French translator. I've had the same translator over years.
German. I thought you were studying Japanese for about a year and just abandoned it.
I was my first year in college. It's a very, very difficult language. And one that I did not keep up. But I don't know. I don't think there's been a lot of interest in my work in Japan, honestly.
I say that because sometimes what happens, you know, museums and things of that sort, you know, open up and all of a sudden there's a gift shop. There's books there that's a compliment, you know, reading, you know. And I know there's a number of, you know, museums, you know, like in Hiroshima and other cities, Nagasaki, where you're dealing with remembering, okay, this is what happened when the bomb was dropped. But what happened to people in other parts of the world? How were they affected? And I think that's when we look at, like, say, even the Holocaust Museum here in Washington. It's not just a Holocaust in terms of what happened in Germany, but, you know, okay, we have a program dealing with what happened in Rwanda because of the theme. And we want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. Which goes back to what I was saying when I was reading your work about, I felt all of a sudden more aware of what was happening with the possibility of people being deported, because I knew there would be that point where they would have to be detained first before they were deported. And so I just was concerned about that. But I wanted you to read one more section that I selected. This gets back in terms of the return of Japanese people who have been placed in these camps. And you talk about the language. Some people say internment camps, but they were actually concentration camps. And that language, you know, sort of like when you say concentration camps, people immediately think of, you know, like, you know, Jews and the Holocaust. You say internment camps or just internment facilities, it seems like it has a different tone on the tongue.
Yeah, well, concentration camps, that was actually the term that was used at the time by President Roosevelt and politicians. That's how the camps were referred to in the newspapers. And this is before the news started coming out from Europe about the death camps. And internment is technically not correct because that refers to people who were not American born, only foreign citizens can be interned. So I think we've sort of settled on the word incarceration camps, but I mean, I will sometimes use the term concentration camps, but I will also say that, you know, I don't mean in any way to compare the camps here with the camps in Europe and what happened to the Jews.
Well, let me ask you a question before I ask you to do this last reading. If you look at both books that we can talk about all three books, what were some of the things, let's say for this woman, that you learned about Alzheimer's and dementia? What did you learn about that you maybe didn't know about the Japanese internment? And what did you not know about the picture of brides until you did historical fiction? You're doing research. So there must have been things where you say, okay, I'm doing this research. I stop and say, well, I didn't know this.
Oh, pretty much everything I didn't know. So I didn't know anything really about the picture brides. But when I was on book tour for Emperor, several people came up to me and they just said their grandmother or their great aunt came over as a picture bride. And then when she stepped off the boat, she was shocked to see that her husband was so old or so dark or so ugly, you know, not the man in the photograph. So I think whenever I am beginning a book, it has to be something that's very new for me, and a place that will engage my mind for the next few years. So I really start out knowing very, very little.
Would you say that in terms of, say, for example, you're teaching a workshop in historical fiction, mm-hmm. is it important for a person to begin saying, well, I've always wanted to have this interest in such and such, or the fact that, okay, I'm in the class and I get an assignment and I stumble across something that I didn't think I would be writing about, but because I'm in this workshop, I start writing, you know, as opposed to something that I always wanted to write about?
Well, option two was the way that I began writing When the Emperor Was Divine. I started out writing comedy, and
I knew you were a very funny person, Julie.
I'm crossing my work, but more so in Swimmers. But I started writing, I had this, you know, sort of a vision of this woman encountering a sign, and it just came to me when I was in graduate school at Columbia. So I just wrote this, what I thought was a one-off short story, which is now the first chapter of Emperor. But I never thought that I would end up writing a book about the incarceration of the Japanese Americans. You remember the literary landscape 20, 30 years ago was very, very different. Back then it was not a marketable story. I thought, no one's going to want to read this. But
let's stop you right there.
Yeah.
They do want to read it because the writing is really, really good.
Thank you.
But let's hear you read the this at the end. You could set this up, but I just felt this would be a really good entry to read in terms of from the Swimmers.
Okay. So this is one of the last visits that the daughter has with her mother in the care home. Every time you leave, you bend over and give her a kiss. Sometimes she pulls away. Other times she looks at you and offers up an indifferent cheek. Always, as you are walking away, you can't help yourself. You turn around and look back. Sometimes she's watching you, but she doesn't seem to recognize your face. Sometimes she's gazing off into space. Sometimes she is leaning over in her wheelchair and staring down intently with fierce concentration at the top of her feet. She has already forgotten you. Today, however, when you turn around and look back, her hand is half raised in midair and slowly waving goodbye.
Julia Soka, reading from The Swimmer. You know, I wanted to connect that because it was something else that I remember reading about when people were talking about, you know, remembering what happened in the camps. Some people did not want to remember because of the shame and guilt. And I was wondering, I know sometimes, I've felt this myself, you leave a loved one, you know, you're leaving, and it's that turning around and you see how someone's health has declined, you know, you're leaving them by themselves, you're leaving them with basically like a staff of strangers, and, you know, how do you deal with that when you're a writer in terms, okay, I know I'm writing this, how detached can I be from this?
Yeah, I didn't feel very detached at all, actually, from the second half of the swimmers. I felt it felt very, very personal to me. I mean, and there still is just a sense of, you have to make a decision at a certain point, you know, are you going to go home, devote your entire life to taking care of a loved one? And for my mother, it was really, she had a lot of other medical issues going on, and she really needed full-time care, which is something that, you know, nobody in the family was able to do. But there is just a horrible sense of guilt that you feel just putting somebody in a facility. It's, I don't think it's the way that any of us want to end up. And yet.
And, you know, you say that, and this is my last point. You know, you say that, but then when I go back, I look at, you know, when the emperor was divine, the family comes back and somebody's living in their house, you know, so that's a thing. Okay. Anyway, Julie, I want to thank you very much for being my guest today. My guest today on the margin has been Julie Osuka. She is the author of When the Emperor Was Divine, The Buddha in the Attic, and The Swimmers. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM, and the show is on.
African Diaspora International Film Festival and Africa World Now Project hosts the 17th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C., August 2nd to the 4th at the George Washington University Student Center, featuring fiction and documentary films, receptions, and Q&As. ADIFF D.C. from August 2nd to the 4th at the George Washington University Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org. Or 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
From Rahsaan Roland Kirk to Assata Shakur, WPFW has been your go-to for cultural and political education since 1977. Your contributions have allowed us to uphold the mission of liberatory media set forth by our founders. August 11th through the 24th presents another opportunity to support WPFW during our summer pledge drive. Donations can also be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Dab returns to WPFW beginning Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. till 5 a.m. with music memories, the best of old school from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Yes, the return of Alvin Nedab on 89.3 WPFW FM, Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly five decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways you can contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need. Running or not, it can do wonders for WPFW. So, donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Expansions joins WPFW Tuesday, August the 13th at 2 a.m. Hosted by veteran broadcaster Vince Brown, Expansions will feature dance music from around the world, including funk, disco, rock, and world music from the 1970s through the 1990s. Before ending the journey, we'll feature the sounds of jazz, both funky and straight ahead. Expansions will be a welcome journey for WPFW listeners every Tuesday from 2 to 5 a.m.
The WPFW is looking for volunteers to answer phones and enter donor information during our summer membership drive beginning August 11th through August 24th. Phone volunteering is a fun way of meeting new people and possibly your favorite programmers while also supporting the station. Need community service hours? Phone volunteering is the perfect solution. Contact us at volunteers@wpfw.org or leave a voice message at 202-588-0999, extension 1008. That's volunteers@wpfw.org.